A variety of concerns have arisen over CT or CAT scans. A new study shows that some types of CT scans may elevate the risk of cancer over the long term. Also, the Food and Drug Administration is broadening an investigation into several hundred cases of radiation overdoses. Those occurred with a special type of CT scan used to image the brain. NPR's Patty Naiman explains.
The FDA is looking into more than 300 cases of radiation overdose at three hospitals in Los Angeles County and one hospital in Huntsville, Alabama. FDA officials say there may well be a lot more cases at hospitals nationwide. These are special types of CT scans which look at blood vessels. They're typically done on the brain to diagnose a stroke or aneurysm. But they require more radiation than typical CT scans. Dr. Jeffrey Schurin is acting director of the FDA division that oversees radiological devices.
You can think about a regular CT scan to the brain as being about the equivalent in radiation of 100 chest x-rays. And a CT perfusion scan of the brain is several hundred chest x-rays. And the patients in these cases received, who got excess radiation, received the equivalent of several thousand chest x-rays.
The FDA sent alerts to hospitals and healthcare facilities nationwide that perform these specialized CT scans, asking them to double-check the machines to make sure they're configured correctly. Schurin says it's not clear how such overdoses could have happened.
It could be due to human error. It could be due to problems in the design of the CT scanners, or it could be a combination of both.
The companies that make the scanners involved, GE Healthcare and Toshiba, say they're cooperating with the FDA and hope to resolve the situation quickly. The hospitals say the same thing. For the patients, though, the experience has been life-changing. The amount of radiation they received, 3 to 8 times the recommended dose, can lead to radiation poisoning. In Los Angeles, 64-year-old Trevor Reese had two of these perfusion scans after suffering what was later diagnosed as a stroke.
I had hair falling out, obviously washing my hair. I had flaky skin. My face was red. You know, people kept saying to me, oh, you know, you look really well. You look suntanned. I haven't been anywhere, you know, I've just been in hospital.
And about 10 days after he came home from the hospital, Reese says the nausea set in.
Nausea is nonstop, you know, it's just 24 hours a day.
Reese lost 20 pounds fairly quickly, and he wasn't overweight. Today he's quite thin and walks with a cane. He's easily fatigued and often quite dizzy. He's suing the hospital where he had the scan. His lawyer, Bill Newkirk, says he has several clients with the same story.
That amount of radiation produces tissue destruction. We've found that consistently among all of the people who have contacted my office, and there's a large number of them, all have characteristic symptomatology that is consistent.
Similar to the problems suffered by Trevor Reese. So far, reports of radiation overdose have only been reported with these special scans that look at blood vessels. But some health experts say all scans add up to too much, increasing the overall risk of cancer. In a study from the Archives of Internal Medicine released yesterday, Dr. Rebecca Smith-Bindman from University of California, San Francisco, found major variations in the amount of radiation used for all types of CT scans and estimated cancer risk from the scans.
For an abdominal and pelvis CT scan, I think if a 40-year-old woman underwent a CT scan, her risk of getting cancer from that CT scan was about 1 in 250. So 1 in 250 patients who underwent that kind of CT scan would get cancer directly from that examination.
And that was the average. But for the patients who got higher doses or more frequent scans, cancer risk increased even more. Smith-Bindman says standards for radiation dose should be universal and tightly regulated. And she says CT scans can be just as effective with lower doses of radiation than what's used today. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
Today in Your Health, we look at strokes. It's the third leading cause of death in this country. Most survivors have permanent disability. There is a drug that studies say can stop a stroke in its tracks, but few victims get it in time. NPR's Richard Knox reports on one woman who did.
Beverly Sylvia was having a perfectly ordinary day.
It was just like any other day.
After work, she went for a routine checkup at her doctor's.
Everything was fine.
It was a Tuesday. Sylvia goes out with friends on Tuesday nights to shoot some pool.
So I was getting ready.
She took a bath.
Then I got out of the tub, and all of a sudden my arm went kind of numb.
She shrugged off the numbness as a pinched nerve and drove 6 miles to the VFW club. Once she got there, she felt funny.
They said, "Do you want to play?" And I said, "No, I'm just going to sit here." And I had gotten some soda, and I went to drink it with the straw, and I couldn't drink. I couldn't swallow, you know. I said, "Okay, something's going on." And then when I went to talk, the words were not coming out.
The awful thought dawned on her. She was having a stroke at the age of 49.
I remember when my father had a stroke and everything that happened to him.
Her father spent the last 15 years of his life disabled and depressed.
I'm like, thinking to myself, okay, now what am I going to do? And I finally got the word stroke out.
But to her horror, her friends didn't believe her.
They're saying, "Oh, you know, if you go to the hospital, they're going to do all kind of tests. They're going to check your blood." And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, they think I'm taking drugs. And it's amazing what people think, you know. That's the last thing they think, you're having a stroke.
Sylvia was beginning to feel desperate. She didn't want to call 911 because she didn't want to go to the nearest hospital. Nobody would know her there, and she wouldn't be able to tell them what was wrong. So she makes a decision that will turn out to be crucial. With her left hand, she fishes out her cell phone and speed dials her best friend, Linda Rose.
I had just gone to bed when the phone rang, and I thought, who is calling me at this time of night? And I was like, should I answer it or shouldn't I?
Since Sylvia can't speak, a friend takes the phone and explains that she thinks she's having a stroke. Put her on the phone, Rose says.
I said, well, why don't you have them take you to the emergency room? And she's like, mm-mm. And I'm like, well, call the ambulance. And she's like, mm-mm. I'm like, you mean you want me to come and get you? She's like, mm-hmm. So I said, okay, I will be there as soon as I can.
Sylvia manages to get Rose to understand. She wants to go to St. Luke's Hospital, 8 miles away in New Bedford, Massachusetts. It's where her father was treated. Stroke specialists say Sylvia couldn't have chosen a better place.
Well,
that's because St. Luke's has a direct link to the stroke center at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, 75 miles away.
Hi.
Within minutes, the St. Luke's staff calls Mass General.
Can you hear me?
They get Dr. Raphael Carandang on the phone.
Okay.
He's the neurology fellow on call.
There.
He promptly activates the video link. What you hear is an actual recording of the telemedicine link-up that night.
This is Mrs. Sylvia.
Hi, Mrs. Sylvia. This is Dr. Carandang at Mass General.
On his computer screen, Carandang can see Sylvia lying on a gurney in the St. Luke's Emergency Department.
Here.
A clock above her head reads 11:38.
Okay.
That'll turn out to be important.
Any other relatives there?
By now it's pretty clear Sylvia's having a stroke.
Her friend is here.
But what kind?
Okay.
If it's caused by a blood clot, there's a medicine that can potentially halt the stroke and stop further damage. If it's a hemorrhage, she might need emergency brain surgery. The wrong decision could kill her.
You mind if we do a real quick exam?
Yep.
Through the video link, Carandang can see a CAT scan of Sylvia's brain.
Thank you.
It shows no evidence of hemorrhage.
Good.
So she might be a candidate for the clot-busting drug called TPA.
Can you ask her how old she is?
If you ask the patient if they can tell you how old they are, then it'll give you an idea about speech and thought process.
Yeah, she's trying.
I could understand everything he was saying, but it just was not coming out of my mouth. The answers.
Can she put her arms out in front of her?
The doctor in Boston is putting together a picture of what's going on inside Sylvia's brain.
When she tries to lift her right arm up, she can't, you know, she can barely get it off the bed and it drifts down right away.
Each symptom tells him what part of her brain is starved for blood flow and oxygen.
I'm going to zoom in on her face a little bit here.
By this point, a senior Mass General neurologist is online. Dr. Anand Viswanathan is watching on his computer at home.
As you can see, her right side of her face droops and her lip is drooping. This is indicative that she's having a stroke, which is affecting that side of her face.
Viswanathan can tell that Sylvia's stroke is a major one.
A lot of brain tissue stands to die.
If the clot is not dissolved fast. So now the doctors have to find out something critical.
Miss Sylvia, what time did this start? And you have to be very clear because it's very important regarding the medication.
The medication has to be given within 3 hours of the first symptom. Too late and the drug can cause bleeding in the brain, devastating disability, or death.
What time did this all start?
Yeah.
I know at that time what time exactly this all started. And I was trying to say it because I knew it was crucial. And it wasn't coming out.
It's all right. You're going to have trouble speaking. I'm going to give you some choices. Tell me when you think it started, okay? Did this start at 5 o'clock in the evening?
Sylvia shakes her head, no.
8 o'clock?
No again.
9 o'clock?
Yes. Sylvia nods vigorously.
9 o'clock?
That is because Karandang realizes okay. Sylvia's got to get the drug before midnight. That's less than 15 minutes away.
It meant that we would have to speed things up very, very quickly and act very, very fast from this point on. I was hoping she had more time.
Can we have somebody start computing a dose? You said she's how many pounds?
The person who starts computing that dose is Nurse Barbara Davis.
I remember at that moment, we were kind of like, oh no, we're about out of the window and she's not going to be able to get it.
Now Dr. Karandang needs to get Sylvia's consent before he can tell the team down in New Bedford to start the clotbuster drug.
The risk of the medicine is that it can make you bleed in your head, which could be potentially dangerous. Do you understand the risks of the medicine?
Sylvia's lying there, speechless and helpless, and thinking about her father, how he ended his life unable to move and unable to speak. She doesn't want to end up that way.
I was thinking that I was just going to go for it because I wasn't going to be like this. I was going to try anything.
So there wasn't any doubt in your mind?
There was no doubt.
After Sylvia gives her consent, everything speeds up.
I've got it ready to go. As soon as we get that second line, I can get it started.
The time is running. I mean, we're running out of time, actually.
There you go. You can give me a bowl of things.
Just as the clock reaches midnight, nurses start the drug flowing into Sylvia's arm. Minutes later, she's aboard an ambulance for the hour-long ride to Boston.
So I remember I was, like, perfectly still all the way up. I mean, I didn't move, you know. I just, like, was on my back. That was it. And they had to have the nurse, and she says, I'm here for all the way up to there.
Nurse Barbara Davis says the whole way up, Sylvia couldn't talk, and her muscle weakness was unchanged until the very end.
We were literally pulling into Mass General. And I said, Beverly, how are you? And she said, I'm fine. And I was so shocked. I'll never forget that. It was like the symptoms were gone.
I was like, wow, I can talk. And that's a good thing. And I'm saying to myself, wow, if it's that medicine, it really worked.
I see a lot of patients, but she always stuck in my mind just because she had such a great outcome.
She was in the ICU for a little while, and she got out by the end of the week. And on Saturday, she went dancing.
That's great. I did not know that.
Well, that's a recovery.
That is a total recovery.
This is the kind of case that you want to see, where they recover completely to the point where they were before their stroke.
But Dr. Karandang adds a note of caution.
It's what you want, but it's not what you see in majority of cases. There are some cases that still have some deficits. We'll still have to get some physical therapy and rehab before they get to where they're going to be in terms of recovery.
In fact, some doctors think patients like Beverly Sylvia are just lucky. They don't believe studies that claim this drug can abort a stroke. But they'd have a hard time convincing her of that. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
Quitting smoking is tough. People try gums, patches, acupuncture, psychotherapy. 14-year-old Speck Mellencamp has turned to Facebook. Not for himself, he doesn't smoke, but for his father, John Mellencamp, who's a longtime puffer. Mr. Mellencamp Sr. has said that if his son can get 1 million people to join his Facebook group, he'll quit. Speck Mellencamp joins us now from the studios of member station WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. Mr. Mellencamp, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How many people have signed up so far?
About 200,000.
Well, it's getting there, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What did your father say when you told him that you're going to do this?
He didn't really think that it could ever get to that high of a number.
As far as you know, has he ever tried to quit smoking?
He's tried, but he hasn't really been able to do it for more than a couple weeks.
Do you think he'd like to quit smoking?
I think he would like to, but I just don't think he ever had the willpower to.
If it happens, what can having 1 million people telling him to do that you and your family telling him can't accomplish?
The peer pressure of just having it. And he says that if a million people do that, then if somebody sees him doing it, then he'll seem like the bad guy, so he kind of has to.
Are people leaving comments on the Facebook page?
Yeah, my favorite comments that I get are from other people saying that if it gets to a million, that they would quit too.
Oh, so this could set off something.
Yeah, I've gotten lots of them, and I've also had lots of people tell me about stories of loved ones and friends that have died from lung cancer and smoking-related stuff.
So is this something I asked you? Does your father check in on this every day?
Yeah, he asked me how many people I'm up to about every day.
What do you read in his face, his emotions? Is he beginning to think, oh, no, this might work?
I think he's really surprised because he told me he thought it was just going to be a couple of my friends who joined the group.
So do you have a deadline, Mr. Mellencamp?
No.
So just whenever you reach a million, that's when it kicks in for your father?
Yeah.
So is he's still smoking right now, though?
Yeah, but he's cut back a lot because it hit 100,000.
And you ever tempted to look at him and say, will you enjoy it now, because...
Yeah, I actually have said that a couple times.
Mr. Mellencamp, nice talking to you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Spec Mellencamp, his Facebook group is called 1 Million to Join. My dad, John Mellencamp, will quit smoking.